chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them,
but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
No me diga, a very special episode of Rom-Com Killjoys. We're breaking our hiatus very briefly to talk about the summer's hottest movie, In the Heights. Before we get started, I'm going to throw it over to my beloved co-host and our very special guest. Hey, y'all. Good morning.
Hi.
Hey.
First of all, we have my very, very good friend Ian with us today. And why don't I let you introduce yourself?
Hello, everyone. My name is Ian. I go way back with Eliza. We go back to the college days of sitting late nights in the basement of the campus chapel, pretending to do homework, but not actually doing homework, and talking about Star Wars and musicals instead. I currently work in higher ed and will be unemployed in a couple months, and I have a deep love for musicals and musical theater and music in general. I was a music major in college, vocal performance, and I am also the son of an immigrant as well. My father, born and raised in Panama, and he and my mom came to the U.S. In the 80s after Noriega. There's a little bit of my background as to who I am and why I have so many thoughts and feelings about this movie that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I grew up right outside of New York, and so I was really lucky to see In the Heights when it was originally on Broadway in 2008 with the original cast, and I was just blown away, and it just changed. I mean, it really did change so much about the dialogue about Broadway musicals in the area, certainly, and just sort of the way everyone viewed what could be done on those kind of big stages, which was amazing. And then a little connection that I have to the movie, the main street that they filmed on, where Nina's house is, and they like continually film them all walking up and down that street. My brother lived on that street for a couple of years. You can literally see his apartment in a bunch of shots.
What?
Wow.
So, like, they really did film up in the Heights. They were right up there. They're not on 181st, which is the street that gets name-dropped in the show, but they're on, it's whatever, 178th.
That is awesome.
Of course, my brother kept being like, ugh, they changed that shop window, and ugh, that's not a store, that's actually an apartment building.
Rosario's Dispatch doesn't even exist. What are we talking about here?
It's wild.
I feel like the position that I'm going to occupy in this conversation is I'm more of an LMM, if you will, an LMM skeptic. I have a skeptical relationship to the LMM expanded universe. Great admiration and respect for everything that he has done for the theater industry, which truly, and I mean this, cannot be discounted. And if somebody's out here discounting it, they have to stop. But I do have questions. I have questions for Lynn, and I think that's where I'm going to be in this conversation today. I love this music, though. I will say that. I think the music in this show is unbelievable. Particularly, and we'll get into this, the fact that this show came out in like 2007, 2008 on Broadway is actually a miracle, because Broadway in that era was trash. And I say that as a theater historian. It was bad.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree with you. The like few years around that, most of the other big sort of, you know, blockbuster musicals, as it were, that had come out were revivals or were sort of bland things. And then this really brought a new story to the stage in a way that, I mean, hadn't happened ever, but also just wasn't happening like right at that time. And that changed it.
An original non-adaptation musical, like y'all don't even know, listeners, what a revelation that
and
was.
And then you add that it's not written by or about white people. And it's like, what? Who knew that could happen? Janelle, do you want to give us a little summary for those who don't know what In the Heights is about?
Yeah, I suppose I should throw a bone to the non-theater kids out in the audience. All right, so here, as is tradition around these parts, is your Google summary for In the Heights, the year of our Lord, 2021. Ahem. In Washington Heights, New York, the scent of warm coffee hangs in the air just outside of the 181st Street subway stop, where a kaleidoscope of dreams rallies a vibrant and tight-knit community. At the intersection of it all is a likable and magnetic bodega owner called Usnavi, played by Anthony Ramos, who hopes, imagines, and sings about a better life. So that summary does not actually tell you what In the Heights is about, like on a plot level. But no, it does, doesn't. I guess. I guess it tells you what it's about, like, thematically. So I'll toss it back to y'all. That's what Google says the themes of In the Heights are. But what would you say In the Heights is really about?
Well, I'm going to jump in. I'm going to let Ian take the real grid of that question. But I want to start by saying that In the Heights, the musical, is about Nina. And In the Heights, the movie, is about Usnavi. And that's something I want us to talk about later. But Ian, what would you say on a broader scale In the Heights is about?
I think you nailed it. I think that In the Heights, the year of our Lord 2021, is what happens after the massive neoliberal success of Hamilton. And that is what we get. We get this very glossy picture of Washington Heights focused on the story of one character as opposed to the story of the whole block, right? And I think that's actually what In the Heights, the Year of Our Lord 2021 is about.
Yeah, and I was saying this to Ian before we recorded, but I'll repeat it for the listeners, that I think what I kept thinking about when I was watching this was, you know, some great musicals are not meant to be films. And there's a reason for that. This is an ensemble-driven musical, which, as Eliza said, you know, a real standout sort of protagonist in it is Nina. But films are always seeking out this kind of, like, one central character. It's very rare to have a proper, especially a musical, ensemble movie. And I think that, yeah, the kind of cinematic form for this musical was not ideal in that way, because you get so much. I've never seen this stage, but my understanding is you get so much out of seeing the ensemble interact with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the cool things about the movie is also one of its failings, which is just really unfortunate. An unfortunate reality of the medium, because they were able to do these huge scenes in, you know, in these big locales with a lot of people in the chorus. They were able to really expand what they were showing, but that also takes away from the hyper-focus. You know, you have a lot of moments where lines that are, you know, sort of throwaway lines in songs, but that are sung by various members of the sort of core eight ensemble cast, then get said by just random people on the street, and it loses a little something. You know, one of the moments that struck out to me, it's a dumb little thing, but when they're singing 96,000, which is the song about the fact that someone has won the lottery, each one of the characters at the start of the musical walks into the bodega and buys a lottery ticket. And then you get each one of their initial responses to finding out someone's won. And the one character who doesn't buy a ticket is Vanessa. And when she hears that someone's won, her response is, "I never win shit."
Right.
Which is funny because she didn't buy a ticket. And instead they just gave it to, like, a random guy, you know, in the larger ensemble in the movie. And, like, it's a nice line, but it didn't, like, tell you something about a character because it was just said by a guy who you never see again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I've seen the movie twice now, and both times I've found myself trying to really, like, separate the two works from, like, recognizing that a film is a film and a stage show is a stage show, and always trying to get away from that original source bias. But I completely agree that I loved seeing the, like, all of Upper Manhattan go out, like the power go out in blackout. Like that's something that you can do in film that you can't do on stage. But exactly like you were saying, the smaller things get missed, and just some even bigger character choices. I don't know how you can kill off Priscilla Lopez and make Nina a Disney princess, right?
Yeah, let's talk about that a bit, because they do, in one of the plot changes from the musical to the movie, they remove the character of Camila, who is Nina's mother, and give her a single father, which is a great moment for Jimmy Smits to be able to fill that role. But I think that by removing the one actual mother character that you have in the musical, you lose the array of mother type characters that the musical so beautifully presents you with, because you've got, you know, Nina's mother, Camila, and then you've got Abuela Claudia, who isn't actually a mother, but has sort of adopted everyone, you know, on the block and become everyone's abuela. And then you also have Daniela, the woman who runs the salon, who a little less so than abuela, but has sort of taken in these younger girls and is helping them to, you know, to learn and to get work experience and gives them advice. And some of the advice is kind of shitty, but, you know, she's sort of loudmouthed and funny, but she doesn't take any shit. And you get this beautiful range of these three women who are all so different and, you know, such different Latinas. And I just by taking one of them away, I feel like you lose a lot.
Yeah, yeah. You also lose in the movie. She's an invisible or offstage character in the play, but Vanessa's mother, is this, like, that familial relationship between Vanessa and her mother is the source of a lot of her anxiety and the source of a lot of her financial stress and why she wants to get out of the barrio.
Right. You've got Vanessa sort of coming from an unstable home environment in comparison to Nina, who comes from a much more stable home environment with two parents who both work, who are both active in her life. And the two of them as friends, you get that comparison between how they view the barrio. And that was, I thought, a confusing choice, because that's like a one-line throwaway that tells you so much more about Vanessa than you know otherwise. And, right. You know, like, making the decision to get rid of Nina's mother is, like, a huge choice. But I feel like they very easily, without changing anything, could have kept in a line or two about Vanessa having to support her mom and not have, like, lost time.
It's funny, though. We've talked about this before, how in films, the shorthand of, like, removing a girl's mother, like, automatically makes the girl into, like, a sort of Bildungsroman character coming of age, right? All of a sudden. And what's weird about that, though, is that in the stage play, like, you still have that effect. Like, her kind of coming, both women coming of age still happens with their mothers in the picture. But there's something about our expectations for cinematic storytelling that, like, we just expect girls coming of age to have lost their moms. And I don't like Sigmund Freud, but I know that that's what's going on here. And it deeply, profoundly upsets me.
Yeah, it's such a strange choice that they decided to really double down on that particular movie trope.
Right. It's like, so to fall in love, you have to have some sort of weird Electra complex where you're always trying to please the invisible father or whatever, the imagined father, or the actual father. So you go out and find a new one in the form of a boyfriend. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. Why did I ever read feminist theory? I hate it.
Although at the same time, what is also kind of removed from the movie plot is that the subplot of Benny and Kevin Rosario not getting along at all.
Especially,
and I'm sure we're going to talk about some of the racial stuff going on, but like, the anti-blackness that is in Kevin Rosario and in his character originally, of Benny not being good enough, the one like black lead in the original, Benny not being good enough for Nina because Benny's not Latino or properly Latino, is you know, definitely something that is a fair and real criticism and thing, something to be discussed about in Latinx circles and communities, that Afro Latinx and colorism that is present.
Yeah, I found that really interesting because, like you say, this movie is riding on the coattails of the success of Hamilton. And while it's amazing to have a movie of this, you know, caliber and size be entirely about a Latinx cast, this is in many ways presented for a white view still. And I felt like they took out the discussions of race because they were like, we can't let white people know that different non-white races, like, also have beef.
Right, yeah.
Well, this was originally supposed to come out in 2020, too, before the racial justice uprisings in Minneapolis that really kicked off around this time last year. So I also wonder if they just sort of decided, like, well, for the film version, what we're going to do is we're really going to focus on immigration as the political issue and theme, which we're going to just decide has nothing to do with anti-blackness for some reason, and just, like, put that plot thread under the rug because it's too complicated for us to address in this moment, but we can address that immigration is something that's sort of top of mind with the late stage Trump administration. That's what I imagine has happened here.
Oh, absolutely. And it's very interesting. You know, Ian, you bring up colorism, and there's been a lot of discussion of colorism around this movie. Because while the movie is entirely about Latinx people, the main cast, with the exception of Benny, who is cast very obviously to be Black, are quite light-skinned. And considering especially that that Washington Heights is a very Dominican-heavy population, many of whom are Afro-Latinx or are darker-skinned, there was a small outcry, but an outcry about the casting choices when they first came out in regards to this movie. I'm curious what your guys' thoughts are on that.
So I didn't see the outcry initially, and I didn't see the outcry when the casting decisions were made. I've seen the outcry, especially now, moreover, that the film is out there in the world and released to the general public. But I think it's a very fair and criticism about this work. And what is Lin's role in telling this story where, you know, he wrote himself as this Dominican character, but he's coming from this Puerto Rican background himself, and which is, you know, two totally different Latinx experiences.
Well, and it's interesting you say that, and this is going to bounce us to a yet another topic that we've already touched on a little bit, but you say he wrote himself as a Dominican character. He wrote the part that he was playing as a Dominican character. I would argue his character is, in fact, Nina.
Yeah,
that is the character which he has said many times in interviews is based on his own experience. And Nina is Puerto Rican.
Right. That's true. That's true. Yeah. The character that he embodies and we all know him for.
Yes. No, you're correct. He wrote his character as being from the DR. But there is, and I think, again, if you aren't familiar with you know, Latin immigrant communities in the United States, you might not be familiar with the nuances of coming from these different countries in South and Central America or from the Caribbean. But there is a real difference in the experiences that a lot of these immigrants have had. And one of the things that I really love about the musical is it does touch on that, right? It touches on the sort of variety of experiences they've had, depending on if they're first generation or second generation, depending on what country they've come from, depending on if they came alone or came with their families. And, you know, and to have a musical that not only shows a, you know, person of color story, but many POC stories is really wonderful.
Yes, yes. Which is why I love the musical itself. Mm-hmm. And why I will go back and I will keep rewatching this movie.
The other thing is that I really love about the musical, and I think that the movie did capture, is that it's a positive story, right? Like, it shows people struggling, but it is so joyous. And I think that in this regard, the choice of John Chu as director really worked well, because he is so good at creating these colorful, bright, movement-filled sort of landscapes for his movies. And I feel like that really was on display so well in this, right? Like, this was happy and excited, and these people were, you know, coming together in community and celebratory. And it was like, that part of it was just so much fun to watch.
Yeah, I had the same thought, that he was like the perfect director for this piece. I will say, though, that one place where I feel like the film struggles in terms of direction, that is also a product, I think, of just how Lin-Manuel Miranda writes musicals, is that the pacing is tough in this film. And we discuss that it ends like five times. Can we? Am I allowed to say that In the Heights has pacing problems?
Is no, you are totally allowed. My house? I am not coming for you. I am agreeing with you and trying not to go too crazy, like, musical theater obsessed, you know, ranty about this, because they moved some of the songs around and then they cut a few songs from the second act. And I really feel that because of it, the pacing is off and the first half of the movie is so much stronger than the second half of the movie.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But also, absolutely, throw it out to Lin-Manuel Miranda's dramaturgy, though, too, because frankly, and again, musical theater fans, do not come burn down my house, but the first act of Hamilton is far superior to the second act, and I will die on that hill. I will die on it. And it's the same problem that I think this musical has. It's just like a quirk of his composition, I think. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right, Eliza, though. Some of that moving around and the way that they cut songs also made it feel quite laborious, right, in the second.
Yeah, I think the original musical has a few very clear sort of rises and falls in energy that help the plot to move along quite well. The first act is all about tension building, and then it all comes out in the act one finale, which is Blackout, and ends with Look at the Fireworks. And because they didn't want to have this be a two-act movie, they built that differently, and the big Blackout and Fireworks number started to rise as if it was climactic, but then just kind of fizzled out. And then in the second act in the musical, you get the sort of the remaining energy left over from that climax at the end of act one, which then moves into the very sad and emotional energy of dealing with, spoiler alert, Abuela Claudia's death. And then you get a very clear comedy moment that breaks the tension. And then you get the rise to the end of the musical. And, you know, and those beats are, I think, very deliberate. And it didn't feel deliberate in the movie. The second act felt all over the place, and I was very disappointed by that.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed the second time seeing it was that I was feeling, okay, we have these songs just because we know these songs exist and we want to hear these people sing these songs. Mm-hmm. The music isn't always serving the narrative or the drama the way that it does, the way that it's supposed to, the way that music in any genre is supposed mm-hmm. to.
Yeah, I think that was one of the places where John Chu failed as a director. I think that he did the individual musical numbers really great, and, you know, and a lot of the visuals really great, but that, you know, having the song really serve to move the plot was not as evident.
Yeah, I thought the standalone sequence with Abuela Claudia particularly was, like, absolutely stunning. I think it might have been my favorite in the film, especially the visual. And again, I haven't seen this staged, but the visual references to Cuban culture that were so specific mm-hmm. in the way that it was filmed, all of the dancing and the movement and the lighting was just exceptionally beautiful, I thought.
Well, and shout out, in the musical, it honestly is similar in a lot of ways, the way they did the staging for the original off-Broadway and then Broadway musical, in that you have this sort of movement through time in the lighting, in the costuming, in the whatever, through time and space as she goes from Havana to New York. And they did that so well. And one of my favorite things that they did is that all of the dancing on the subway, they were on the old subway cars.
Yeah.
So they were on like the 1940s and then the 1960s subway cars as she was sort of moving her story through time, as well as the costumes changing and that kind of stuff. So I just thought that was a beautiful detail.
Yeah, yeah. Her character is one of my favorites. And I think that the movie is disserved by how her story ends, where it just kind of fizzles out. She's robbed of being like the thing that brings Usnavi to say, no, this is my home. This is my block. I'm going to be telling your story. And I think that's true. I think we've talked about this earlier, but that's true of a lot of the women characters that are in the musical that are taken away from the movie is, we lose that female, maternal, rootedness.
The other thing I think they robbed her of, which I watched the movie a few days ago and I've been thinking about it over and over and over in my head and trying to sort of word the things that frustrated me. And with both Claudia and with Kevin, with Nina's father, I felt like the way they did the movie robbed them of their anger. And one of the things that the musical does really well is it showcases that tension and that frustration of all of the things that don't go right as an immigrant, as a poorer person, as someone who's really had to fight and struggle. When Abuela Claudia sings her song in the musical, at the end of it, you find out she's won the lottery and she knows she has the winning ticket. And first of all, it's this huge tension breaking moment because you've been waiting to find out who won. But second of all, she's frustrated and angry and sad because she's had this whole life of scrubbing floors and fighting for everything. And now right at the end of her life, she's won all this money. Like, how is that fair? And what do you do with it? And, you know, and there's an element of anger there. And Kevin has the same thing when he sings about feeling useless when it comes to his daughter having trouble at school. And he's worked so hard to give her the opportunities to be able to go to school and afford it and all these things. And now they're worried about her being able to stay in. And there's frustration there, both for himself and at his daughter, which he feels, you know, mortified by, that he's angry at her, but he is sort of mad that she has opportunities that he didn't, that she's not taking the opportunities, you know. And that's not a pretty thing to talk about, but it's a very real part of that experience.
Yeah, come to think of it, that actually might be the thing that I respond to the most in The Heights, is that, you know, there's a lot of great sort of musicals about, I don't know, about neighborhoods and cultures and community in a sense, right? But what I think that this piece does so well is that it leans into those tangible effects of oppression. I mean, by talking about money and property and gentrification in these, like, very clear terms, I mean, it's really bringing to the fore, like, no, we're not just talking, like, oh, thematically, like, you know, we're the barrio and we're the, you know, we're ghettoized in the city. But it's like, no, we are systematically financially oppressed.
Although one of the things that that I do like about the movie is money is an issue for the Rosarios, definitely, and Nina. But bringing in her Latinx identity and background, being put into this predominantly white institution that is Stanford University, and the feeling of, what am I the first generation star successful college student Latinx, am I going to be with the waitresses, or I was searched when my white roommate's pearls went missing. And that feeling of not fitting in, I think, I really loved how that was explored in the movie. One of the highlights, I think, of the movie for me.
Right. Well, and I really loved the moment when she was explaining about her experience where someone mistook her for a waitress. Her father was like, there's nothing wrong with being a server. And I thought that that was a great response, because it both showed his attitude towards the situation and also his lack of understanding about what she was experiencing. Because she was trying to explain to him that, like, no, for us, there's nothing wrong about being a server, because people we know and our entire community sort of serve those type of roles. But I was in this situation where the other people who were theoretically my peers do see something shameful about being one of the waitresses. And so to be mistaken for one is really embarrassing for them. And from the culture I come from, that's not a thing that would be an insult or an embarrassment. But now I'm trying to fit in with this different, you know, right? Like, there's all those things going on in her head. And her father, who comes from a working class environment, was like, what's the problem? You know, and just dismissed it as his daughter being overly sensitive, or, you know, something like that. And I think that those generational differences also were on display, which was a very subtle but really nice touch.
I think this is a really good place to return to talking about why we think, and also maybe how we see Usnavi taking over as the central protagonist in this film.
So for background, for anyone who's not as familiar with every detail of Lin-Manuel Miranda's life story as we are, he grew up in Washington Heights, and then he went away to school to Wesleyan, which is in New England, in a very white school. And he based the character of Nina, which he began writing the musical when he was at school, and it was first performed in workshop through his theater program at college. And he based the character of Nina and her story both on his own experiences and on the experiences of a few other Latinx friends who he had made at college, who were all having this struggle of trying to afford tuition, trying to fit in with their white classmates, and trying to explain back home what the struggles of college were like to people who had never gone away to big universities. And so it really started as a story about Nina, and then as he expanded it into a full ensemble musical, that's when he wrote in the character of Usnavi as the, you know, the sort of character who ties it all together, the narrator, the, you know, whatever you want to call it. And it grew from there. But it really did begin with the story of a 20-year-old struggling at college, and that's where you get Nina and her entire story.
Yeah, and I wonder if, you know, because I think, especially when y'all are talking about Nina's conflicts and her sort of trajectory through the piece, I mean, her story, Usnavi's story is very compelling also, like deciding that this is your home is a very compelling thing, but her story is particularly compelling, it's particularly detailed, it really has that touch, as you say, of something that the you know, generative artist really took some care with. But I think that what's interesting is about In the Heights, the musical. If you're not a theater person and you haven't seen this musical, you haven't listened obsessively to the original cast recording or whatever, when you think about In the Heights, the image you see in your mind is that iconic picture of Lin-Manuel Miranda, right, in his shirt, pointing up to the sky as Usnavi, right? So in a way, mm-hmm. I think the film is just reflecting back that in the sort of cultural consciousness, Usnavi is the representative character of this musical, even mm-hmm. if he's not really the protagonist, which I think is an interesting meta conversation we could have about the role that Lin-Manuel Miranda now plays in the kind of mm-hmm. theater economy right now. Which is interesting because Anthony Ramos is playing Usnavi, and yet it's still like, I'm still thinking of it as like, yeah, but that's Lin.
I literally referred to the character as Lin yesterday when I was talking to my friends about it. I was like, yeah. And then when Lin says, and they were like, Anthony Ramos, Lin was not playing the part.
For the record, for anyone who hasn't seen it, Lin plays the Piragua man, and it's amazing.
And he's fine as the Piragua guy.
It's probably the hardest song in the whole show, and Lin is many things, but a singer is not one of them.
No, there's a reason he wrote his part to be entirely rapping. Yeah, the Piragua guy in the original musical is actually the one who's sort of narratively singing with every song. He's got a part in almost every song in the musical as the sort of background amazing singer, and they cut that out when they gave the part to Lin.
He knows now, right?
You mentioned the thing about the soundtrack of the original Broadway cast recording, and I'm going back and I'm thinking about the way In the Heights was initially advertised, and my recollection, or looking at some documentaries about it, is that Graffiti Pete is much more prominently displayed. I mean, he's the guy in the poster who's like doing the backwards breakdance move that some dancer who's listening probably knows the name of, that I don't. And there's the PBS documentary about it, talks about him seeing that actor seeing that poster go up on Broadway, and how he's featured in it. And but you're right, the soundtrack album is Lin doing the Hamilton pose. That it's a disappointment to turn the movie into the focusing on the mediocre man, which is, I love Usnavi, but he's also a mediocre dude.
He's fine, but it's also like, I don't know. I mean, we talk about star text a lot on this show, and I do mm-hmm. think that Lin's star text is all over this, obviously, in all the ways we've been talking about. And also, like, when I found out we were going to be doing this movie, literally the first thing I heard in my head was, lights up on Washington Heights up. Like, how can you not? It's such a part of the text around this musical. Yeah, yeah. But I think at least, I mean, we can talk about this, that like, I'm really glad that they put Anthony Ramos in this role, though, because I think he brings a lower frequency sort of grounded energy to Usnavi that I really appreciated. Mm-hmm. And plus, he's a very pretty boy. He's a very pretty man, and I appreciate that.
He is absolutely a gorgeous, very very attractive human being. Mm-hmm. Although that has been my biggest complaint, one of my not biggest complaint about this movie, is that Usnavi is not the pretty boy.
Right? Is Anthony Ramos too sexy to play Usnavi?
Anthony Ramos is absolutely too sexy.
No, Usnavi is such a dork, right? Like, he's a total dweeb, and he's, you know, he's into pop culture, and he, you know, raps in the park with his friends, but he also, in the first song, in the first few lines, mentions Cole Porter, and mentions, like, do you know how much of a dweeb you have to be in 2008 In the Heights to be, like, referencing Cole Porter songs as you're walking around the neighborhood? Like, what a dork.
And not just referencing it, like, my man, Cole Porter, like, four words that would not get you laid in high school.
He starts singing You Must Take the A Train. Like, this is not the cool kid. He might be friends with some of the cool kids like Benny, but he's not the cool kid, which is why he's been trying and failing to get Vanessa to go on a date with him for, like, years.
Absolutely. I have a hard time believing Anthony Ramos has a hard has difficulty getting with Vanessa.
I know. Those eyes. How do you say no to those eyes? You don't.
Right.
You, just, you
right.
will.
One of the oddities in the movie that I'm very curious to hear both of your thoughts on was the inclusion of sort of pseudo, what's the word I'm looking for? Like pseudo magical realism elements in some of the pieces.
I mean, okay, there's a lot going on with this. First of all, I'll say like layer one is like, what a lovely tribute to a sort of, you know, important art form that emerged from Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. Second layer of that, that has absolutely nothing to do with the storytelling language of this musical in a way that makes me itchy as a dramaturg. Layer three, however, that is something that they can make use of in terms of the cinematic storytelling, that if they tried to do it on stage, someone would have thrown a tomato. So so I feel like I've landed in a place of sort of ambiguity about it. Ian, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I'm in the same place. Pretty ambivalent about it. It's a tool of the medium, and they decided to use it. Okay.
I feel like I don't have a problem with them using it. If you're going to do it better.
Yeah, do it. Make it actually part of the storytelling language. Don't just throw it in every... Okay, I'm sorry. Like, magical realism is a overarching narrative form. Like, you can't just decide to have a moment.
If they were really going to go down that route... Every time Usnavi started talking about people having dreams, like the cityscape should have started to sort of melt behind him into whatever the person was dreaming. Mm-hmm. Or every time, you know, Vanessa sort of zoned out, like you should start seeing the bolts of fabric rather than being like in this one song for one moment, even though the rest of the song has been filmed from a complete realism standpoint, we're now going to have these giant bolts of colorful fabric fall from the sky and like not reference it again, not have it tie into anything earlier in the song. If the whole time that she was working her way downtown to go apply for this apartment, you were seeing that in her head, the world sort of comes alive and she's, you know, mentally dressing people up in her, you know, a wardrobe, you know, designs and things like that, it would have been cool. Instead, it was like, they were like, oh, we have this computer program that can make these bolts of fabric fall from the sky.
Yeah, and I think my ultimate feeling about the movie is rooted in that. It's a series of really great music videos, very, very loosely strung together.
Which is disappointing, because that's not at all what the source material is like. And you're going to change it because it's a different medium, but... you want it to reflect the quality of the source material.
But it also comes back to this conversation that people were having around the Cats adaptation last year, and this is nowhere near that. I'm not saying that.
Don't you dare.
I'm not. It's not even...
There's a secret cut out there with Lin Miranda's butthole.
Yes.
Release the butthole cut.
Release the butthole cut. I'm so sorry for everyone who's not like deep in musical theater internet. Anyway, so it's part of the same problem, which is that like some musicals should not necessarily be made into films because the reason that the musical form works on stage when it does is because you're giving the suspension of disbelief that, right, I'm in a theater and people are just singing at me. That's weird. So I'll kind of accept that all kinds of weird and magical things are going to happen, right? But that's why movie musicals really have to take a slightly different approach. They have to be more consistent in the storytelling language. Like you're saying, Eliza, like when you go from sort of these like very well shot, very realistic scenes to all of a sudden somebody turns around and there's an entire crowd of extras behind them staring at them, that can get a little, it can get a little bit disorienting. So I don't know. I feel like my final thought on it is let musicals be musicals. And hey, now that theaters can open again, go see a musical on stage.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, although the overall content of what you just said, I agree with completely. I don't think this was a musical that shouldn't have been made into a movie, because I think that there are a lot of benefits to putting this on a screen and filming this on a live street. Like I said, my brother literally lived in the Heights on the street where they filmed, and it looks like the street. There is a mechanic shop at the end of the street, and there are just guys chilling on the street at all times who, like, maybe work for the mechanic shop, maybe you're just friends with the guy, but, like, they're playing checkers, they're hanging out, and if someone's car breaks down, they're all, like, jump up and help. And that was, like, happening on the scene, right? And I think that there's something about, especially for people who don't live in the New York area or in an urban area, who aren't going to be able to see, you know, the professional Broadway version of this, to be able to see a version of this that has those real elements and really gives you a flavor for what Washington Heights and what New York City feels like, can give a lot of context that if you're just seeing like a regional production of this movie put on by regional actors and directors, like you really may not get that flavor. And so I think that there's a lot of benefit to that. And I think that there, again, were a lot of really cool things they did. I loved the big dance number at the pool. I loved, you know, what they did with the, you know, people in sort of Cuban early 20th century attire then dancing on the New York subway. You know, there's some elements there that I think really do add something. But I think that overall they could have put more thought into how they transcribed it into the new medium. And they didn't do that well enough.
I haven't seen Crazy Rich Asians, but I've seen like stills of it and some scenes from it, and it's interesting to me to think like a lot of the same conversations that were happening around Crazy Rich Asians, both in terms of it's so great to get a totally non-white story being told, but also all these characters are really light skinned, happened there, and it's happening here and in the Heights. And, you know, John Chu is really great at making these beautiful, colorful, vibrant scenes. And I think at the expense of some of that more real life thing that we want to see in a story that is about, that is very grounded in reality.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of places to grow, but also there's a lot of excitement in being able to make this movie and being able to get, you know, execs at Hollywood to fund it and to produce it, which, as we've said before, it's a shame that that's still an uphill battle, but it is. And so when something like this succeeds, that is very exciting, and I think that is ultimately a good thing for the industry.
Special episodes where we come to thank our patrons on Patreon, and this is one of the great episodes. Woo! Where we have one of our patrons on with us, which is the bomb. So hey, so as per usual, we're here to thank our romantic leads who are especially generous in their support, and they are Bob, Esther, Trey, and Ian. Hey, thanks, Ian.
You're welcome. It's a delight. It's a delight to be here, and y'all do a great show.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks. If you want to become one of our Patreons, you can go to patreon.com/romcomkilljoys. We're off for the rest of the month, but we will be back next month, bigger and better than ever, probably. Don't hold us to that. So we're very excited to bring you a bunch of new content. We've got fun stuff coming up. So if nothing else, stick around and keep listening.
So, friends, I'm going to land in an ambivalent place this week in terms of my recommendations, in terms of my companion pieces that I want to offer to this film. So I'm wondering what you all are thinking. Ian, what sort of suggestions would you offer to our audience? Antidotes? Supplements?
Suppledotes, if you will.
Suppledotes?
Yeah. So the first one I have is it's a really beautiful book. Called I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter by Erica Sanchez. It's a coming of age story for a first generation American young girl living in Chicago, dealing with the death of her sister, and really great. It's a powerful story, beautiful story. Highly recommend it. Want to read more stories by this author now. And then I mentioned it earlier in the episode. But the PBS documentary about In the Heights, the great performances, it's called Chasing Dreams. If you can find it on your local station, it's worth an hour sitting down and watching it and seeing all these characters when they are babies.
Eliza, what do you have for your supplidotes?
My supplidotes this week, if you are looking for more Latinx stories that are available very easily and on a sort of broad public sphere, I would go watch the TV show Jane the Virgin. I'm sure I've already recommended it before, but I would literally recommend Jane the Virgin in every conversation I ever had if people wouldn't start hitting me over the head. it's one of the best TV shows I've ever watched. It is a sort of American reinterpretation of a lot of Latinx television tropes. It is in and of itself a telenovela, but it also has just, you know, a lot of sort of magical realism elements, like we've talked about earlier in the episode. It has an absolutely phenomenal cast. It talks, like this movie does, about immigration issues and dreamers and political issues. And it has a very wide range of Latinx cast who all talk about their own experiences. And it is so funny and so smart and so moving. And if you liked In the Heights, you will definitely for sure like Jane the Virgin. It's also one of those shows that's like so bright and colorful. It feels like you're watching a musical even when you're not. The other thing I would suggest is a book that I read recently that I also can't stop recommending enough to people, which is The City We Became. It's by N.K. Jemisin, and it is a fantasy novel, modern fantasy novel, about the city of New York. And in it, essentially, the city of New York is being attacked from within by sort of otherworldly forces, and a number of people in the city come to magically embody the five boroughs. So you have a character who goes by the name Manny and becomes Manhattan. You have a character who embodies Queens, a character who embodies Staten Island. And it's very weird because it's very sort of magical and trippy and strange, but it also is such a good sort of contemporary look at the way that the different parts of New York see themselves interacting with each other and individually. And it's just really cool and really smart and interesting. And I think everyone should go read it. Janelle, I'm sure that you have some wonderful suggestions for us. What are your supplidotes?
Well, my supplidotes, since obviously I have major problems with any musical being adapted into a film, I guess, or any play being adapted into a film, I just want you to do the theater thing instead. I've got two supplidotes. One is a filmed live performance, and the other one is just a straight-up film with music and dancing. The first of which is the one-man show Latin History for Morons by John Leguizamo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's not always terribly sensitive in its language or its approach to certain identity intersections, let me say. But what I will say is that the piece is a wonderful, nuanced rundown of the history of Latinidad and how complex, varied, and distinct the relationships are between all of these nations and then also the diaspora of those nations in places like the United States. And it's a place where he gets to be vulnerable and talk about his relationship with his children who are, you know, mixed race. And their relationships to Latinidad as well. So I can't recommend it highly enough. Also, it's absolutely hilarious. He's an amazing performer to watch. The other supplidote that I have for you is the 1991 film Danzón, the Mexican film directed by female director Maria Navarro. It's about a woman named Julia who is this single mom, and her like one escape from her like, you know, pedestrian life is to go dance with her dance partner, Danzón, right? One night he disappears, so she decides to throw caution to the wind and go looking for him. And it takes her on this incredible, like, woman-centric journey that is all about, like, love and family and finding family for yourself and carving out a space of joy for yourself. And it just felt like such a female-centric companion to many of the joyful things that we see in the Heights. So that's Latin History for Morons and Danzón.
What lovely suggestions. I also want to throw out there, for those of you who aren't familiar with the original musical, there are a number of songs that were cut for the movie, some in ways that I think make sense and some ways that I don't. But I would strongly suggest going and listening to the songs Inútil, which means useless, and Enough, which are the two songs sung by Nina's parents in the musical that did not make it into the movie and are both phenomenal.
Definitely.
Yeah, just go listen to the original Broadway soundtrack. It's real good. Real good.
It takes like an hour. It's great. Listen to it.
Ian, this was so wonderful. I'm so glad that you came on and talked to us about this. Hearing your musicals thoughts, and I was really excited that you wanted to talk to us.
Happy to be here. Thank you for letting me share my thoughts with y'all.
Anytime. We'll have you back anytime, Ian. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Well, goodbye, everyone. Go listen to a soundtrack.
And we'll be seeing you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time. Starts and kissing and making up.